Today on Wings.
I had to really face the darkest expression of Islam very intimately, and I was afraid.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Asra Nomani is a well-known Indian-American journalist. She is also a revolutionary Muslim feminist, author of tracts such as The Islamic Bill of Rights for Women in the Mosque and The Islamic Bill of Rights for Women in the Bedroom. Her first book was called Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. Today on Wings, Part 1 of Asra Nomani's speech at Yale University.
Thank you so much for having me come here. It's such an honor. I was a good Muslim girl growing up in West Virginia when my dad and mom told me, you're not going to go anywhere to college but our hometown university. I listened. But I'll be taking the college tour tomorrow morning just so I can, relive old memories that I never had. So when I was thinking about this talk, I wanted to call it Breaking the Silence and talk to you about this personal journey that I've taken and use that as a window into a larger revolution. The personal is oftentimes global, and that's why I think I'm here before you. Where I was as a little girl here in America, I came at the age of 4, part of the brain drain out of India in the 1960s. My dad came for his PhD, and I joined later with my brother and was part of, so many immigrant stories here to America. I felt separate. I felt like I didn't belong. And so I went into writing as my place of expression. But writing was always private. It was always something for just myself. I didn't share my inner thoughts with anybody. I didn't express them to my own parents. I just journaled and cried into my journal, like a lot of little girls might do. And the issues that started emerging as I, as an adult, look back at my journals are the ones that mark my work today. And one of them was a window into my younger self. I was raised first in New Jersey, and then we moved to West Virginia when I was 10. It was 1975, and the Muslim community in Morgantown was very open. We would gather, as we are gathered here. The men and the women would interact freely together. We would have our dinners openly. And then what happened in our Muslim community is what was happening globally through the 70s, a growing conservatism, fueled in part by the exportation of more puritanical Islamic theology from the newly found wealth of oil-rich Saudi Arabia. And so into Morgantown came a lot of conservative ideas that included gender segregation. And so I didn't know the bigger politics, as a girl. I just knew my own personal experience with it. I went to a college dorm one night for a dinner party, much like you would have any dorm here. And we had the lobby downstairs. It was the medical center apartments. And the lobby was reserved for the men of our community. And I, along with the other women and girls, went, and we were sequestered away in one of the efficiency apartments where one of the Muslim families regularly lived. And as a little girl, I hated it. I hated the fact that my brother was downstairs, in the spacious room, running around freely, and I was cooped up in this little room. And the men would bring the aluminum foil, trays of food and biryani and all of the other meals and leave them at the door, knock, and then run away, as if to see us was to turn them to stone. And it was felt terrible and strange to me and foreign, because this wasn't the values and the ethics that my family embraced, even though my parents were very traditional and conservative. My father had had me, you know, stop wearing dresses when I was 9 because it was inappropriate for a girl to bare her legs, and I was definitely not allowed to go to the junior high school dances. But, you know, this kind of fear and separation was not part of their ethos. And so that night, in that little journal, I wrote that it felt like a prison, and I didn't like it, and I didn't express myself again. And that was part of the start of my silence. You know, that was when I was hitting the boundaries. I was hitting what in the Muslim world we know as the hudud, these boundaries that are supposed to define our values. And I was too afraid to cross them. You know, at that age, I didn't go downstairs. I didn't claim my right to the open space. I didn't even know really fully that I had that right as a girl within Islam. And so what happened for me is what I think happens to many girls and women within organized religion. And I started feeling disillusioned. You know, I started having a crisis of faith. I had been praying 5 times a day as a young girl, enthusiastic about memorizing the Quran. But with that experience and so many more, I started wondering, is there a place for me in the faith? Is in the rest of the world, you know, at West Virginia University, a woman named Judith Stitzel was starting the Women's Studies Department, and we were the first generation of the beneficiaries of the feminist movement in America. And I was told what all of you have been told, you know, growing up in America, for those of you who grew up here, that you could be everything that you wanted to be, that there were no limits to your dreams, that there were no closed doors, there were no boundaries for your dreams. And so this was a disconnect for me, because even though my parents mirrored that messaging, I thought my community and my religion didn't. And I didn't have the desire or the will to challenge. And so, like happens to a lot of people, I started leaving the faith. Increasingly through my teens and then into my 20s, I didn't feel like I could belong. And so I succeeded in the secular world. I became a reporter for the Wall Street Journal out of college and, you know, interviewed CEOs and chiefs of staff and heads of state, but I never crossed the threshold of our mosque back in Morgantown, because since I was a little girl, I knew the rule. There wasn't room for me, literally, at the mosque. My brother would run with my father to the mosque for the Friday prayers, but my mother and I never went. And this was a message that was reinforced within the community, because none of the women became the leaders. You know, my father was a founding member of the board of our local mosque, but my mother and none of the other women who were the wives of the community leaders ever emerged to rise to the board seats of any of the Muslim leadership positions that we had. And so for me, this was my silence. This was my silence through my 20s and then into my early 30s. You know, I learned to become a great journalist by the highest standards of newspaper work, but I didn't touch any of the growing issues in the world regarding rising conservatism in the Muslim world. I knew through my own window into my family about the growing influence of Wahhabism, the theology of Saudi Arabia, into the world. I knew it from the stories of my family in Pakistan. I could see my relatives growing increasingly conservative and rigid in their interpretations of Islam, but I never even wanted to go there. I didn't want to touch it. And so I crossed all sorts of boundaries as a journalist, I started writing about issues of sexuality. Got, you know, a story on the front page of the Wall Street Journal about increasing safety issues because of so many people wanting to join the Mile High Club and airlines. I mean, I talked about the increasing number of people who didn't consummate their weddings because they already consummated their relationship so that it wasn't necessary on their wedding night to do the deed. So I would kind of push the envelope on societal issues, but I just, the things that resonated within me, issues that angered me and ones that I wondered about, but I didn't want to touch it because it was too close to home and I didn't feel like I could talk about these issues of religion with any seriousness because I felt like I didn't have a legitimacy because I had felt so disillusioned for so long that I didn't feel like I had a right to speak. And so, like a lot of people, September 11th was a wake-up call for me. I knew at that moment that I had to go to Pakistan and I had to try to write about Islam and I had to try to write about this world that seemed to be in clash with the West. And so I went to Pakistan and I reported for Salon magazine over there. I wanted to try to explain Islam. I wanted to try to explain more about the issues that were relevant in the Muslim world, try to explain extremism and this disconnect with the West. And there in Pakistan, I had what I guess is what Oprah calls, you know, your aha moment, right? Your moment when you just realize that you have been sleepwalking a lot through life. And I think this is a moment that comes to each one of us at some point or the other. For me, it was when my dear friend and colleague from the Wall Street Journal, Danny Pearl, came to visit at a house that I had rented in Karachi. I had decided I would stay there to finish writing my first book. I'd fallen in love with a man in Pakistan, and I was gonna give it a try. I was gonna find the divine love that I was pursuing as a journalist. And I thought I'd found it. You know, he was a good Muslim guy. He spoke my language. He was the immigrant dream, right? Bridging the world. And I was, you know, again, in pursuit of this fantasy, really, that I had come to desire, trying to be the girl that I thought I was supposed to be. And so there I was in a house on a street called Zamzam, and my friend Danny came to visit with his wife, Marianne. She was just had a belly that was swelling from the conception of their baby. They just learned the day before that he was going to be a boy, and we celebrated. We tried to watch DVDs on his laptop that night, and I'd gone out and bought a 5-track CD player because I knew he loved music, and you know, ran and bought bootleg CDs of Bruce Springsteen and anyone else I could find just to show him I could show him a good time so they'd come back because I needed friends in Karachi, and that was then the last that I was going to see my friend because, as most of you know, he went for an interview where he thought that he was going to find the local handler for Richard Reed, the shoe bomber. And we waved goodbye outside my house. Danny was fumbling with everything as he normally did. And that was the last moment that we saw him. And the next that we saw of him were the images that most of you have probably seen of so many journalists now since then too, with a gun to his head, his hands in chains. And that was when I realized, you know, what serious business this world was in. I realized too what the stakes were for Islam in the world, because that first ransom note was from a group that called themselves the Group for the Sovereignty of Pakistan, and they said that they were they had kidnapped Danny because he was a Jewish, you know, intelligence agent for Israel, and that they had kidnapped him in the name of Islam. And so sitting in my house on Zamzam Street, I heard all that the police were finding, you know, that the photos had been dropped off at a mosque during a Friday prayer, that Omar Sheikh, who was later prosecuted as the mastermind, had plotted the kidnapping along with three others there in Karachi, breaking as the call to prayer would erupt around the city, and they would break their strategy sessions for prayer. And then we learned that, you know, the people who had kidnapped were part of these militant groups that had emerged in Pakistan since the 70s. And I realized that people who call themselves Muslim had taken an innocent man, a man who was just eagerly awaiting his son's birth so that he could teach him how to play the mandolin one day. And I had a real sadness, you know, a real sadness that this was the faith that my parents had taught me being practiced in this way. You know, I'd lived through 9/11, I'd rushed to New York City, but it hit home now. You know, it hit home in a very serious way. And would have been traumatic with just that level, but then I had to face the darkest expression of Islam very intimately a few weeks into Danny's kidnapping, when I learned that I was pregnant. I didn't have a wedding ring. I was single. My boyfriend had bailed on us the day after Danny's kidnapping because he didn't want to get involved in this international dragnet. And when I called him to tell him and saw him to tell him that I was pregnant, you know, that universal fear kicked in, and he told me, I don't want to have anything to do with the baby. And I knew why, and I knew that, you know, this was that taboo. I mean, this was a taboo that American women had to cross decades ago. This was the taboo that many women still have to face if they can. Pakistan was a country where the charitable organization left something called jhulas, cradles, in the yards of their charity organization so that people who had babies out of wedlock could leave them there so that they wouldn't get dumped in the garbage bins. And, you know, I was afraid. I was afraid of getting my blood tests. I was afraid that I would get caught and dragged in, because now I was in the middle of the scene anyway that was full of all sorts of conspiracy. And there then, in that moment, I had to confront the question of whether I was going to be able to take action, and action in the most intimate form of whether I was going to be able to stand up for life, basically, or abort my baby out of fear, because that's what I would have had to have done. It would have been fear of going into this world without a wedding ring and being a mother. And so these were the dilemmas and the issues spinning in my head as then I learned, along with the rest of the world, that Danny had been murdered, and had to confront this question of whether Islam was a violent religion. Is this what Islam taught us, that these men could cut him into pieces in the name of religion? I mean, was I supposed to also kill my baby inside of me for the name of religion, because that would keep me proper and legitimate? And this is what faced me, but I know that in so many people's lives there are other issues, there are other fears that we have to struggle with in trying to decide whether we can stand up or not. And so for me, the journey took me back to Morgantown, pregnant. My parents told me that they would welcome my baby into the world and they would support me, but still afraid, you know, so very much afraid. And And it was with the birth of my son, then in October 2002, that I knew that I had to try to get my strength to stand up, because during that time I heard of the case of Amina Lawal, a mother in Nigeria who had become pregnant and who was facing a stoning sentence. And I wrote an email to myself, you know, in the craze of my pregnancy, and I said, I have to get strong in order to speak out for women like her who can't. And through tears and anguish, I brought my son into this world, and when I saw him, for all of you who have, you know, had a newborn brought into your hands, you know, it was my rebirth. I mean, it was my new birth. It was the possibility and the potential of my new, stronger self. And so I went like that on a pilgrimage to Mecca that is the first half of what I write about in this book, Standing Alone in Mecca, where I wanted to go see for myself whether Islam, if there was a place for me in Islam, whether I, as a human being, as a woman without disguise, could feel like there was a place for me. And it was there that I walked, as every pilgrim has to do, in the footsteps of a great woman named Hagar, known as Hajar in Islam, a woman who is largely forgotten in history, like so many women. Abraham had left her in the desert. She was the surrogate mother. She was the concubine. She was the slave. And she was a single mother. I mean, at the end of the day, she was a single mother in Mecca, raising her baby Ishmael. And as a Muslim, we are required on the pilgrimage to run in the footsteps of this woman who ran between two hills. And on her seventh run, desperately seeking water, holy water sprang from the earth. And this water was called Zamzam, the same name as the street on which I had lived in Karachi. And I realized, as I felt her pulse, that that Zamzam was within me. It was within all the women. It sprang, you know, from the earth through all of us. And I had the same potential as she did, and all women do, to overcome our fears and to find our rightful place and to know our full strength and to live fully self-determined lives. And I loved it. You know, I felt it didn't matter to me that the Saudis weren't going to let me get in a car and drive. I knew that I could be beyond that. Like, I knew there and then I had to cover every strand of my hair, but I knew that outside those boundaries I could be my full self, and I could harness the power of the symbolic woman who was the symbolic mother of Islam. And I returned to America with that determination. I didn't know how it was going to be expressed. I didn't know how I was going to realize it. But I came back to Morgantown, to this town where I had been told that I couldn't go downstairs, where I couldn't go into the mosque. And I saw the opportunity in this new mosque that had been opened up. And the mosque was a brand new $500,000 construction. And I thought, this is a new beginning. And so that was when I walked up to the front door and was greeted with the reality that has sadly come to define our Muslim world of the 21st century. You know, an elder standing at the door, pointing to the back door and yelling at me and saying, "Sister, take the back door." No greeting, no wishing of peace, no kindness. And what happened to me then? I mean, it is what happens to so many of us, you know, when you're taken, you know, you're this powerful, strong woman at that moment in any other place, and then all of a sudden, you are that younger self. I mean, you are that little girl who was told you can't go there, who was told stay in that corner and shut up and stay quiet. And I had the luxury of speaking to a great scholar at University of Georgia, you know, so angry at what had happened. And he said, Asra, you know, your anger reveals a deeper pain. And I knew that that was these decades of pain, of feeling disenfranchised, of being shut out, of not being able to go into the mosques of Pakistan, where I knew that, you know, my friend's photo had been distributed, you know, because this was a forbidden territory to me as a woman. And everything connected to me, you know, it wasn't just about me as an ordinary woman being excluded. It was about all women being excluded. It was about the doors of our Muslim world being closed to issues of tolerance and justice and equity. And, you know, normally if I hadn't had what had happened to me in Karachi happen, I would have walked away and never returned. I would not have cared. I would not have bothered. But I knew through my friend Danny's murder and through the question of my son's conception that I couldn't allow this kind of Islam to go unchallenged. And yet I had to confront that same thing that we all have to confront always, which is our own fear. I mean, I had decades of fear ingrained in me. I had, you know, crossed boundaries, jetted around the world, but I couldn't even walk from here to you to look over the wall of the balcony in which I was expected to sit in my mosque in Morgantown. And I knew it was all about fear. I mean, it was all about the fear of what was going to happen in response. It was the fear of the backlash. And then I watched a documentary about the life of the Prophet Muhammad. And I realized that, you know, the beauty of our faith in the 7th century has been tarnished and destroyed by just centuries of man-made rules and cultural traditions and tribalistic attitudes that, like has happened to so many societies and to so many faiths, erased the real beauty of religious teaching. And I couldn't allow it to continue as a Muslim because Islam was defining the future of our world. I had brought my son into this world. I had given him a Muslim name. I couldn't stand by anymore, silent. And so 10 days later, it took 10 days of this kind of soul searching, going in every day to the mosque. We went as a family, my mother and my niece, into the mosque, into the front door and into the main hall. And we unleashed this, you know, response of anger and yelling and screaming. And all the while, my dad hung with us. He stood there and he backed us up. And the journey, I knew, had begun.
Next week on Wings, the exciting conclusion of Asra Nomani's speech at Yale University, followed by her interview with Melinda Tuhus, discussing the feminist movement and Islam. Wings thanks Melinda Tuhus for the audio in this program. Also thanks to your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. You can hear Wings programs again at www.wings.org. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.